Hello, South by Southwest. It's my pleasure to introduce a local Austin original gamer and astronaut, Richard Garriott. Thank you.
Well, first let me say thank you all very much for coming and joining me today. I know that you know what I'm here to talk about is a little bit off the normal beaten track of a South by Southwest. Why I'm actually here today is last year, we here at South by Southwest, we actually debuted a film. That film was called Man on a Mission. It was a documentary of the space flight that I took in October of 2008. And it actually did very well here at South by Southwest. It actually became a fan favorite and was voted to come back and show again this year. So last night we had a showing of it at the new Alamo down at on Slaughter. So for any of you that came out there, thank you very much. It was very well attended yesterday. It was great to get a chance to bring it back here home in Austin. And for those of you who haven't seen it yet, by the way, it is out now on Netflix, iTunes, and on Time Warner Cable, for that matter, so you should be able to catch it if you haven't had a chance. But what I want to do today is I want to talk a little bit about the future. So that documentary was sort of covering the past, but I have sort of some kind of interesting insights now because of my unusual journey with space and with the various national space programs. Has given me a little bit of an unusual perspective about the future of spaceflight. And so let me kind of take you through a little bit of that. First, just for those of you who don't know me, I have this interesting split life. I'm how I generate my income is as a computer game developer. I'm on my third startup now that hopefully will grow as well as my first two have to become significant contributors into the computer gaming field. But with the money that I've made in gaming, I've invested in exploration, not just space, but everything from deep sea, Arctic, variety of terrestrial, and of course, space. And space became an interest of mine in particular because, not only do I think that every kid grows up thinking space is cool, but my father was also a NASA astronaut, and that kind of made it seem a little more practical and achievable. Set me up to go on that trip. Like I mentioned, the Man on a Mission documentary is now out and available. But in particular, I'm just going to tell you, I have a few slides that just really, I'm going to kind of give you the 3-minute synopsis of Man on a Mission to kind of have as a backdrop to my discussions. When I grew up, not only was my father an astronaut, but literally my left and right neighbors were also astronauts. And so I kind of grew up believing everybody goes to space, because everybody that I knew did go to space. And it was when I was about 12 or 13 years old and began to wear glasses that one of the NASA doctors told me that I was no longer eligible to become a NASA astronaut. And it was basically like being told, you are no longer a member of the club that your father and all your neighbors are members of. And so while before that I would have never said, when I grew up I want to go to space, because I just assumed everybody did, being told I was not going to be allowed to go to space is really what set me on my course to kind of prove them wrong, so to speak. And so throughout my career in computer games, I've invested towards the privatization of space. And while I'll skip all the paths that didn't work, it was really the XPRIZE and a company called Space Adventures that really began to crack open civilian spaceflight that allowed me to be able to go. And it was in early 2007 is when I committed to making my own space flight and began to put deposits down on making my own flight. But what's interesting is even if you've helped bring into existence the business of civilian space flight, it doesn't mean they'll let you go, because you still have to pass a bunch of medical tests. And in my case, during the medical test, they actually found I had a major liver anomaly called a hemangioma. They actually made me remove it. So shortly before I began training, I actually had to go under major life-threatening surgery to have my body modified and then test that it would work before they allowed me to go, which I really hoped, A, I wouldn't die during the surgery, and B, that it would work well enough to let me go, because otherwise I'd already given them my money and I wasn't going to get it back, if you know what I mean. And then finally, in the spring of 2008, I went through the same training that every astronaut or cosmonaut goes through to be able to operate every piece of equipment on board the Soyuz, every piece of equipment on board the International Space Station. And then finally, in October of 2008, I made my own journey to the International Space Station. And as you might imagine, the view from space is pretty spectacular. In fact, of all the amazing things about space flight, so the zero-G, of course, is cool. The launch and reentry are great fun. But it's really the view of the Earth is really the most profound part of the whole experience. And I was amazed at how, in spite of that height you are above the Earth, really how intimate you feel with the Earth. You know, for example, if you look at the shot, you can see the Golden Gate Bridge, the Oakland Bay Bridge, Alcatraz. You can even see the trail behind a ship as it's coming in to the harbor there, too. Just a really amazing level of intimacy in spite of your enormous altitude and velocity going around the Earth. But I didn't go just as a tourist. I really was trying to prove that space was a viable place to do business, not only to offset the terrible ticket price I'd already paid to go, but also hopefully find businesses that I could go again in the future by finding work to do in space that would pay for approximately or as close as possible, or even better yet, if I could make a profit with my time in space. And a few of those, by the way, some of the best results of my flight were things like associated with Earth photography, Earth observation photography. The NASA astronauts who had a picture of something to take on the Earth would get a printout of the target they were about to take a picture of. They would then have to go to a window and find which way was north compared to the direction of travel of the space station and kind of guesstimate as when it would come in front of their view and hopefully see it and get a picture of it. I instead worked with another software developer to create a Google Earth-like scrolling map with the targets all placed on them that automatically tracked exactly the orientation of the spacecraft and gave you a countdown timer that said 30 seconds from now it'll be, 2 degrees out the starboard window. And so mine was far more efficient, and it turns out that the astronauts became so dependent on it, they would often kick me out of away from my tool and the ability to use it, so much so that not only was I often orphaned to just taking pictures of them using my tool instead of actually using my tool, but it is now actually just the last week was adopted as the standard tool now that NASA uses for Earth observation photography. Another kind of unusual result of my flight was I was the first person who flew with laser eye surgery. And so interestingly, the thing that prevented me from ever being an astronaut was the number one thing NASA became interested in studying about me. Because they were interested in allowing astronauts to fly with this corrective surgery, but there has never been even a candidate who has applied, who's had it, because it was never allowed. And so I became the guinea pig. It all went fine, and now all astronaut candidates can now apply and, in theory, be selected even if they've had laser eye surgery. So to kind of take that story full circle. But from a business standpoint, the best work that I believe that I did that I think holds the best promise for the future is something called protein crystal growth, where by growing crystals in microgravity, they become much bigger and much more pure than on the Earth. And if you're trying to get the structure of a protein molecule for medical purposes, it turns out to be very, very, very valuable. And there's been no investment really in it in the 30 years or so. This has been theorized and a little bit has been known about it. And so I began to fly this commercially. I took it up with myself and returned these structures of some of the proteins that I took. We've flown it again with Guy Laliberté, the founder of Cirque du Soleil, took it up on his flight shortly after mine. And it's flying now a third time with a NASA mission here in a few more months later this year. And it looks like this really is something that will not only prove to be commercially valuable, but could be extremely commercially valuable and will succeed at that goal that I set for it, which is pay for future space flights. But then after spending about 2 weeks on orbit, sadly, my time was up. I got on a different vehicle, so now it's my third space vehicle if you count the TMA-13 up, ISS, and now TMA-12 to come down. The reentry, by the way, is pretty cool. If you get a chance to watch the documentary, I filmed the reentry all the way from contact with the atmosphere all the way to impact on the ground. It's the first time that's ever been shown, and there's a few malfunctions and things that occur, so it's kind of exciting, but I live. And it's worth checking out. But in any case, for me, this was a great life experience. It was also a great bonding experience with my dad, who helped me through, do my mission design and planning through my whole flight. So it was really great. And kind of my wrap up of my own flight was really kind of this really renewed and dramatically deepened sense of environmentalism that I walked away with, and a lot of other astronauts do as well. But that's all the past. So what's interesting about the history we've had in spaceflight is to analyze, why we went at all, what things were actually achieved by what we have gone through, and why it feels to, I think, a lot of Americans that either it's not worthwhile and or we're sort of in a lull where we're sort of shutting it all down. And that's a very common perception that even when I talk to NASA employees, for example, it's this malaise about space, or this lack of faith in the future of space, or especially America's leadership in space, is rampant. And by the way, in the sense of full disclosure, I'm a member of something called the Commercial Spaceflight Federation, which is what I'll call the commercial group that is trying to privatize space. But I'm also an employee of NASA now. I'm what's called a special government employee on the NASA Advisory Council. So I'm on the Civilian Oversight Council for NASA. So I've sort of got a foot in both camps. And so that gives me both a deeper sense of knowledge about what all the parties are doing. But also, I clearly have what I call a pro-space agenda, you might say. But if you go all the way back, if you look at when Sputnik was launched, people had never been into space, and that event was obviously a huge event for humanity to finally get something off the planet. And in fact, it is what inspired my father, who was a radio physicist at Stanford. It was what inspired him to want to get into space. And as a radio physicist, that was why NASA found him interesting to hire as an astronaut. And so that sort of has that moment is directly has led to my flight, so to speak, in the sense of it inspired my father to get into space. He flew twice, once on Skylab and then once on the shuttle. And my father's flights, as well as all of the Apollo flights, I would argue is really what inspired not, of course, just me, but my whole generation. The people who grew up with Apollo on television were strongly inspired to get into the classic areas of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and I would argue really gave rise to the high-tech boom that we saw shortly after Apollo. And a lot of, if you go look at the entrepreneurs of the high-tech industry, almost all of them will describe this inspiration. Interestingly, a lot of them are circling back and getting involved in space now again, as you'll see a little later in my talk. But if you look at that, those first 10 years from Sputnik to landing on the moon, it only took about 10 years to put the first object in space to landing people on the moon. And that was almost 50 years ago. So the intervening 30 or 40 years since, we've basically been stuck in low Earth orbit, going no further away than the space station, at least with people. We've sent rovers lots farther, which is cheaper, safer, faster, a great idea to do it that way. But we've still only put, I'm the 483rd person to leave the Earth. And we've just now crossed 500 people who have ever left the Earth in history, still after 50 years. And more importantly, the kind of 2001 version of the future that at least a lot of us grew up believing was going to come never came. And so it's not only disappointing, but you have to kind of reflect and go, like, why is it that has never come, and how should we really feel about that? Should we push on and push through it, or is it really something we don't need to really pursue as humanity? Well, I would argue that the reason why this has so far been true is because space travel is, at least has been, very expensive, extraordinarily expensive, very dangerous. The space shuttle killed 1 out of 70 people that got on it, and it was projected to continue to kill 1 out of 70 people that got on it. That's an incredibly dangerous activity. I mean, it'd have to be a pretty big stack of money across the street for most people to think that I will risk my life to walk across the street and pick up that amount of money, if you know what I mean. So the value proposition has not been that great. And therefore, if it's something that's that expensive and that dangerous, it's not that surprising that it's pretty rare to do. And not only that, but if you look at this 30 years we've been spending in orbit, another part of the cost has been the space station itself. We've spent $50 to $100 billion over about 20 years building it. We spend $2 billion a year just to keep it from splashing into the ocean. And the cost with the shuttle was hundreds of millions of dollars per astronaut to send anybody up there to maintain it, much less try to do some experiments. Again, I'm just adding to this, you know, this crush of expense and danger that's been on top of the program, the way it has been architected in the last few decades. So it's no surprise with that crush that we've decided to retire the space shuttle. It's too expensive, too dangerous. It's been the most successful space vehicle of all time in the sense of people and material that have been put up into space. But it, again, it's not sustainable. We also had a plan. There was a plan that was brought up, put forth during the Bush administration that was called Constellation. It was a giant fleet of rockets and landers that were going to take us back to the moon. And the problem with that particular plan is that it was going to cost us an additional $5 billion a year for 30 years if it stayed on time and on budget. And so not only would you have to increase the NASA budget dramatically, but sustain that increase, and maybe more, for three decades. And so it may not be that big a surprise that no one, including Bush, who proposed it, ever funded it. Not 1 year was that plan ever funded. And so in the recent Obama administration, they all said, look, you know, it's been 10 years already. We've never funded a dollar of it. Let's just admit that we're not going to, and let's cancel Constellation. So again, you go, wow, so everything we're doing in space, you can see we kind of plateaued up, we got into low Earth orbit, and now everything appears to be on the downside, on the downslide, so to speak. And that is completely the public impression. A lot of the NASA contractors, many of whom are losing their jobs, are being very vocal about it, understandably. The states that employ all these people are lobbying Congress not to allow a lot of these programs to die because they're jobs programs in their states. And so there's a huge amount of debate that's going on right about now about space. But now let me rebuild back up. So now that's the bad news. But here's the good news. The good news is that during this period of time where publicly so many people are skeptical or unaware of what's really happening, there's been a true revolution coming in behind it that is now beginning to emerge that I think people will be very excited about. You know, and first, it's important to go like, well, why are we going? In other words, you know, I think that, you know, while space is cool and inspiring, you know, dinosaurs in space, the two most inspirational things to children, but, you know, the price tag and danger still has to pay back in ways that you don't have to try to argue and justify about Velcro or Tang or all these kind of spin-off products that, you know, people might argue have come out. And NASA actually has a great list of those. And in fact, you know, they can make a really good argument for the side benefit that comes out of this activity that is true. But it's just not something everybody on the street can measure easily. There has to be true return on investment that is understandable by the general public. And so, for example, if you now even look at my own flight, you know, the cheapest way to go to space right now is the Russian Soyuz. It costs a few tens of millions of dollars to go. And I worked very hard to find commercial work that I could do in space, and I earned ones of millions of dollars. Okay, so I didn't make a profit, but I did at least make a dent in the huge cost. And so the question is how can we fix that? You know, because by the way, if I can make a profit in space, I'm going back myself a lot. But until then, frankly, I can't. None of us can. None of us should. And so here's part of the problem, or part of the solution. The first part is, you know, what I'll broadly describe as the public-private partnerships, what you might have heard if you follow NASA stuff at all, this kind of COTS or commercial crew activity they're doing. And I'll describe it in a little more detail, but already and how and why this is true. But even this first round of new rockets that are being built with commercial providers are at least 10 times cheaper than the shuttle era was, and probably a little bit cheaper than the Russian Soyuz. I still couldn't make money on it, but it's moving dramatically in the right direction. And by doing these public-private partnerships, unlike today, where even if I had the $1 billion to buy a space shuttle, NASA's not, and you know, NASA helped the airline businesses get off the ground, but they never flew passengers on NASA airplanes. Similarly, NASA will never fly passengers on NASA-owned spacecraft. But if NASA is buying their spacecraft from a commercial provider, then my company can go buy a spacecraft from that same commercial provider. And so this switch that NASA is going to the way they're acquiring their spacecraft is going to also open up for commercial activity to grow right alongside it. And so really, I look at this as it's a very important change of procurement method. Instead of NASA saying, hey, Boeing, build me the space shuttle, and then I will own it and operate it myself, in which case nobody else can use it, Now they're going to go to Boeing and say, build me a rocket, but I just want to buy the launch service. And if ever somebody else like SpaceX comes out with a cheaper alternative, next year I might not buy from you. I might buy from SpaceX instead. That instantaneously provides competition, which is driving this price so far down for NASA. It also is what allows my company to go buy a vehicle from the same company. That increase in flight rate will bring the cost down even farther. And the increase in flight rate also drives everyone's safety up. And so it puts all the incentives, importantly, in a line. And why a lot? And there's a lot of people that are going, yeah, but if NASA buys their rockets from SpaceX or whoever else, it's not really NASA. It's now SpaceX. Which I would argue about by going like, look, you know, everybody knows about the Mars rovers, you know, Spirit and Opportunity and the new one going up there called Curiosity. Those are NASA rovers. It's a NASA mission. No one thinks about it as anything other than NASA. But by the way, those were launched on commercial spaceflight, commercial boosters, the Atlas or the Delta. Completely commercial launch, the same launch that puts up the satellites that you watch TV on. But you don't even think about it. You don't care about the vehicle, the car maker. You care about the mission and who is operating the mission. So it's a NASA mission. And so just like it's a NASA mission to put those robots up, it would still be a NASA mission to put their astronauts up on the space station, no matter who builds the rocket. It already wasn't. They didn't build the shuttle anyway. It was Boeing that built the shuttle. It's just a slight actuarial move that has profound impact on the future. The next major piece is reusability. Imagine if every time you filled up your car with gas, you crushed it and bought a new one. Well, it wouldn't be very cost-effective to drive your car. But any form of truly reusable transport, cars, boats, planes, and trains, they all cost about 3 times the fuel cost to own it, maintain it, insure it, and all the other parts of operation. So a truly reusable vehicle will cost you about 3 times the energy cost that you put into it. Interestingly, on the Russian Soyuz that I flew on, if you want to buy the whole rocket and do whatever you want with it, the Russians will sell you one for about $200 million. The fuel cost that goes into it was about $800,000. So if you imagine that, if that vehicle wasn't destroyed and you'd have to buy a whole new one, 3 times $800,000 is only about $3 million, and there's only 3 people in it, that's about $1 million apiece. Okay? That is the future that is coming. And so already there's private companies like, for example, SpaceX, which a year ago, November, flew into space and reentered a space capsule for the first time. It was the first private company in history that flew a capsule in space, reentered it with a heat shield softly, and recovered the cargo that was in it afterwards. And by the end of this year, actually probably in a few months, they'll actually be taking NASA cargo to the International Space Station under contract. And it's the same vehicle that will ultimately, after they've proven their safety rating, will be taking crew to the International Space Station. And so this vehicle is flying already today, but just most people don't think of it as NASA, most people don't think of it as the future, but it's already flying right now and will be taking crew very soon. And Elon's plans for their Generation 2 is instead of dropping the stages in the ocean, which they do right now with parachutes, is they're actually going to land themselves back under power at their launch site. And so these will be literally completely reusable. There'll be no damage, zero damage done to these parts when they fly, and they carry just about 10% extra fuel is all you got to carry in order to land softly, vertically, exactly where you took off, both the booster stages and the capsule. And so all you got to do is stack it back on top of each other, put fuel back in it, do a little maintenance check, launch it again. And so that's, again, how these are now on the path to becoming truly, fully reusable. It's happening now. And when it does, the cost is going to go from hundreds of millions down to ones of millions. And like I already told you, when the cost gets down to ones of millions, I would have been profitable with the time I've already spent in space. And that was only after working on it for a year to find work to do in space. I mean, so there's a lot of you are great entrepreneurs and will probably think of smarter things than I did. And so I'm very confident when that flips, you're going to see a huge influx of activity for space. And it's important to repeat back here that this is really a NASA-led effort. You know, I mean, SpaceX wouldn't exist if NASA wasn't there as the anchor tenant to buy those services, just like they were, the United States government and groups like NASA were the anchor tenant for airmail. You know, the thing that got the airlines going was airmail services. The government became an anchor tenant with taking planes back and forth across the country, and then airlines began to build on the backside of that. Same thing is now going to happen with space. So when you think about what's going to inspire, you know, our kids and why is space, why should they, you know, when I was just the other day, I was talking to a woman at the premiere who was saying, like, you know, her, she let her kids watch the last shuttle launch, and the kid was really sad at the end of that. They were going like, oh, you know, I wish I could have been an astronaut, but, you know, you just told me that the space is now over. And the mom had to go, no, space isn't over. Don't worry. But this is the way I think that the new generation is going to be inspired by space that is happening again, you know, right now. And again, what's interesting about this is that there's a documentary, another documentary out called Orphans of Apollo. And as soon as I saw the documentary, I said, that's me. They're talking about me. It's people who believed in the Kubrick vision that Apollo promised us, and then it never happened. And so we were orphaned by that lack of completion of that story. And a lot of us who went and started the tech boom are circling back. And you'll see their names pop up in here. And so let me tell you how I believe space is not going to be unfolding in the next 10 to 20 years. And by the way, I think it really all began with the XPRIZE. So back in 1998, when we put together the $10 million XPRIZE, I would argue that was the beginning of this change. The old ways, the status quo, we're not intending to change. It really was the success of the XPRIZE that kind of told people that a different kind of future was possible and began to force people to think in this new way. Already what's beginning to happen now is there's a lot of vehicles being built for suborbital. In fact, the XPRIZE was really a prize for the first suborbital vehicles to be flown. And in 2004, Burt Rutan of Scaled Composites won it. And that vehicle, Spaceship One, hangs in the Smithsonian now. But there's half a dozen of these vehicles being built now. This was an early version of one that the guys at Armadillo were thinking of up in Dallas, but I still just love the way it looks, so I still use it. But of course, Virgin, Richard Branson has bought the rights to that first winning vessel and is now building Virgin Galactic. They'll be flying later this year. The Armadillo guys are flying. That's, what I find interesting about suborbital is John Carmack, who's the author of Doom and Quake, which I bet you guys know his products at least. He was probably the runner-up for the XPRIZE and is still going on to build vehicles that I hope to use for space diving that I'll come back to in a second. But what's amazing about John's vision is as a software guy and as a rocket nozzle inventor, he did a completely brilliant job. What's interesting, though, about everything else you see on that rocket is that you can, and they basically do, buy it on the Internet. And so pretty much any kid that can build a robot to compete in, say, the first robotics competition can now build a rocket that will fly to space. I mean, literally, it is truly that easy. But for example, all the cryogenic parts you need that originally were built for Apollo really are now in your air conditioning system and just outside your house. And all those same parts can now be bought from air conditioning systems and put back into rockets. And that's a slight simplification, really, but you get the general gist of it, which is truly a well-funded high school or college group can build a rocket that will fly at least people, or at least material, if not people, into space. There's another group, probably the third runner-up for the XPRIZE was this group, Masten Space Systems, which is now selling some of these pieces, some of their equipment, even onto NASA and other people. Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon.com, another high-tech guy, I would argue another orphan of Apollo, is now building rockets. He's also building a completely reusable capsule that will self-land under power. There's another group called X-Core. They are building a single, a horizontal takeoff and landing space plane. Takes off with a rocket engine, then just pull back on the stick and go straight up, but then land again like a glider. They already have this physically in construction right now in Mojave. They already have orders for I don't remember the exact number, but my guesstimate is it's about a dozen of these space planes that hold a pilot and a co-pilot and some cargo capacity in the back that will take you to suborbital space and back in manufacture right now. And as I mentioned, one of the things I want to go do is this. I want to go ride a suborbital space vehicle up to space, jump out with a spacesuit and parachute, re-enter, and pop it and land. And even though Red Bull is making a big deal out of they're calling it a space dive, but it's from a hydrogen balloon they hope to do this summer. And in my mind, if you're in a balloon, you're not in space, kind of by definition. And so so don't believe their marketing, that if you really want to go to space, you got to go on a rocket. And so we'll blow away all the records, I think, with rockets. So that's suborbital. And I think that'll be mostly tourism. There is some science to do suborbitally, but it's really mostly tourism. But having done all this space stuff, I can tell you it will be worth it. It'll be about the price of a first-class round-the-world ticket, but everybody can save for that if they wish, and I would argue that it's going to be very well worth it. The next step, though, is getting up back up to low Earth orbit. And what's interesting is all these competitors who are now building these. You know, not only is, for example, all of the NASA prime contractors, everybody that was already building these satellite boosters or Boeing that built the shuttle, they're now all competing in this new commercial era. And so even the rockets that exist, like the Atlas and the Delta, are now being what's called man-rated. Even, they have a pretty good safety rating already. You can just look at the statistics because they've flown hundreds of them. But they're now making modifications that NASA demands to have them meet the what I call the human rating qualification. So they have abort systems and other things of that nature too. But these will be extremely competitive boosters to put human capsules on top of that will be available soon. Then you've got the new entrepreneurial feat people. Like my favorite is SpaceX. I actually think they're currently winning the race by a year or two, and the cost race by perhaps as much as an order of magnitude. So I think these guys are really well ahead. But Boeing is also creating a new capsule, and my company, Space Adventures, actually is the official reseller for the Boeing capsule, for the commercial side of the Boeing capsule. One of my favorite reentry vehicles is this one being built by a company called Sierra Nevada called the Dream Chaser. It's like a miniature shuttle that holds 7 people, and landing on a lifting body, by the way, is a heck of a lot more comfortable than landing in a capsule, having done that. Instead of hitting the ground like a car crash, you can land like an airplane. Huge advantages to it. And while a lot of people might say, hey, well, the shuttle didn't really work that well from a safety standpoint, so why are you going back to a shuttle-like structure? This one's much smaller, much easier to control, much safer, so this should actually do just fine. I already mentioned Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' company. And NASA's also building their own. They're building their own, even though they've shut down most of that constellation, they're still building a crew exploration vehicle. And so for going not just to low Earth orbit, but way far away for much longer periods of time, they're building their own capsule as well. Although, by the way, Elon Musk would argue, and I would probably agree, that Elon's will do everything this will do. So I actually think Elon is, again, I'm an Elon fan, as you can tell, but I think he's cleaning up currently at the current moment of this race. But there's even some exotic ones, like in England, they have a public-private partnership building something called Skylon. It's a hydrogen and oxygen, it's basically a giant hydrogen and oxygen tank with these hypersonic jet engines on the side that can close the valves in the front and burn its own liquid oxygen. It's a single stage from runway all the way to orbit. You know, that Lynx space plane I was talking about is really only suborbital. It's pretty easy to get to suborbit, but orbit is really hard. It takes an enormous amount of energy, but this thing will take 10 tons at a time to orbit one stage, just refuel and go again, should again drop the price of cargo by somewhere between 10 and 100-fold what it is today. But now you need a place to go in orbit. And so, if you look at the space station, NASA and the U.S. government is trying to convert it to being this international laboratory, they call it. While I think I applaud that, and it's a very good thing, they still have a problem with their basic cost overhead. It's still such an expensive structure that unless Congress allows them to change their billing practices to private industry, I'm not sure how much private industry can afford to use it, frankly. Which brings us to the major competitor, which is a guy named Robert Bigelow. He's a hotel mogul out of Las Vegas who has already flown 2 inflatable space station segments into space. So this is an actual photograph from the module flying right now in space. However, that was really just a test module. It's not habitable or anything else, but it's a proof of concept to show that he can launch them, he can deploy them, and that they work. And here in a few years, once we get these vehicles running, so he's actually on a kind of a lull right now, waiting now for the vehicles to become available. He's sort of ahead of the curve. He could go build a station today, but no one could reach it. And so he's on hold, but when he gets around to flying these again, and they'll either add them onto the space station if NASA decides to let them, or they'll build an independent free flyer. But the point is, it'll probably be at a fraction of the cost, both to launch and operate, than anything that has ever been seen previously. And once you're in low Earth orbit, that's when you bring back businesses again, like I was just describing. That protein crystal growth, for example, I think is worth tens of millions of dollars per flight. And so, therefore, not only is there that particular one, but here in Austin, there's another group called AstroTech, which is doing vaccine development on orbit. It turns out microgravity is particularly useful for studying the biology of how vaccines or pathogens interact with each other, which I could go into more detail if you'd like afterwards. But it turns out biological research is probably the first low-hanging fruit of things that once the price becomes appropriate will be very good businesses that can be built on the back of these new capabilities. But then we get a little further out and get a little more exotic. For example, Japan has already announced a $30 billion investment in a giant solar farm to send solar power back to a city in Japan. Now, personally, I actually think this is too grand a first goal. I think it is still so hard to put that much mass and that much assembly in space that me and a lot of the same folks that built all these exotic travel companies, we have our own company. We've started another company. We have one called Planetary Power. And we're starting with terrestrial power collection and renewable energy, but our goal is to put up single launch power generators to where we can beam power to, say, a forward military base, which we can handle that much power with one launch. We can't power a city, we can't get it as cheap as burning coal, but we can build something that is probably very competitive for people like the military front lines where it's very dangerous to bring them power and very expensive to bring them power. But then you move out, and one of NASA's first goals, actually, in this next decade, is to do places like go visit asteroids, because all the heavy metals like gold and platinum, et cetera, sunk to the core of the Earth when the Earth was molten, but it all sits on the surface of asteroids. And so one of NASA's first targets is to go back to asteroids. Here's one Japan plans to go dock with. It's coming by this Atakawa. If you can see in the bottom right there is kind of its orbit as it comes close to the Earth. And, of course, there's gazillions of asteroids that could all be visited, many of which we can just look with a telescope and see what material is on the surface so we can know which ones would be interesting to go visit. But more interestingly, in my mind, is the fact that, when I grew up anyway, these Lagrange points were a big thing to talk about building space stations near Lagrange points and stuff, the L5 Society, that sort of thing. Well, it turns out a lot of things like asteroids orbit those Lagrange points. And so, for example, there's this one TK7 that happens to be right in front of the Earth, just in orbit in the Lagrange point right in front of the Earth. So it's very close by, stays close by, so it's easy to go visit. And if you want something off it, all you got to do is pick it up and toss it back down and make it crash land on a desert somewhere and go pick it up. So so I think asteroid mining is an interesting one to consider. But there's another interesting area that's only recently started coming into the news, which is, we all know about every 200 million years or so, there is a planetary extinction level asteroid that has hit the Earth throughout the Earth's history. And, there's grain of sand sized asteroids that land on the roof of your house every night. And then there's this continuum of frequency versus size, that happens on this curve. And now we're tracking all this stuff pretty darn well in space. And it turns out one of the soonest near misses we're going to have is in the year 2029, this asteroid Apophis is going to come so close to the Earth. It's not only passing within the moon to the Earth distance, but look how close to the Earth it is. It's so close that the Earth's gravity will bend it into a whole new orbital pattern. And that little white bar you might be able to see there near the Earth is actually the calculated error range. So it actually go anywhere in that little keyhole slot. That is mighty close to the Earth. But after the Earth deflects it, in 2036, it's going to come back again, and there's reasonable probability it's actually going to hit the Earth, and they already know exactly where it, in theory, could hit the Earth. Now, they don't think it will. This one, they think, will ultimately miss. But the point is, we're now watching this stuff with this level of closeness, and it is truly only a matter of time before one actually will. And and by the way, there's another one that just made the news even more recently that is now going to come back, and they're still watching it and trying to get better calculations on it to come back and revisit in 2040. And we're now starting to put plans together as to how that one might be dragged away with some solar sails or some other things that might just, you only need to deflect it a little bit and it's fine. But you have to see them soon enough and decide to react soon enough. And these two, for example, wouldn't be enough to cause mass extinction on the Earth, but they'd be plenty big to wipe out an entire city. This may only happen in 1,000 years or 1,000,000 years, but it also could happen 30 years from now. There's really no way to know. And so now let's say we want to go even further away. So let's suppose you want to go back, at least as far as the moon or other planets. Interestingly, my own company, Space Adventures, already now has chartered with Russia and built the flight plan for an Apollo 8-like circumlunar flight, and we already have one customer who's signed up to go, and as soon as we have our second customer to sign up and go, we will start building the actual parts and pieces and fly it. So the next expedition back to the moon might be private, not government. But there's also something you may have heard of, the Google Lunar X Prize, where the Google has put up $25 million for the first private rovers to go back and rove on the moon. So the first things on the moon in quite a while might also be private. By the way, I already have a lunar base as well. So in the 90s, I bought Lunokhod 2, a Russian lunar rover that's there on the moon. And what's interesting about the reason why I bring that up is on the X Prize, there's a bonus prize for visiting a previous existing site on the moon. But NASA and Russia have both said, hey, please don't go to our sites. We really don't want you to crash land on, you know, the Apollo 11 site. But on the other hand, I have the only private base on the moon. So most of the XPRIZE guys are targeting my spot. So I've said, sure, you can come. Of course, I'll charge you a parking fee. But in return, I'll also pay you for pictures of my rover. And we'll just, you know, pass money back and forth. But that will, you know, so private commerce is now being organized on the moon. Once you go out past the moon, you know, by the way, the nice thing about landing on an asteroid is you don't really even land on it. You sort of just dock against it. I mean, the gravity on a spinning asteroid is on the edges is, in fact, exactly zero. Because anything that it's all being held together like loose rubble, and so anything that the centrifugal force would throw off has been thrown off. And the stuff right at that outer edge is only barely on the inside of being held in by gravity versus thrown out by centrifugal force. So literally, you dock with an asteroid. So you don't even need landing gear. You literally can push, you know, your solar panel against it and it wouldn't hurt it. And so it's very easy to go to an asteroid and then come back home if you wish. So gravity is the problem. So going back to the moon, by the way, and coming back, building a base on the moon, as some politicians said recently, I think is not a great idea. I think getting off of the moon is very difficult. The amount of material you have to land to get back off of a planetoid of even that size is enormous. Very expensive, very dangerous, puts it further away in time, and there's really not that much, I think, useful to do back on the moon, even though we could. I'm not sure the case is compelling. On the other hand, we can go to a moon around Mars or Jupiter. It's so low gravity, those are so tiny, you can almost jump off of them, and so it'd be pretty easy to get back home. Again, you wouldn't need much impulse to get back from a base on one of those moons. And not only are those moons good outposts to look for future landing spots on those planets, but a lot of them, like some of the Jupiter moons or icy moons that might harbor life, and there's other good reasons to go back and go visit those moons. But ultimately, I actually think the big goal is to go to Mars. And the reason why I pick Mars is, A, we haven't been there yet. B, it does have, much more so than the moon, it has all the resources you need to sustain life. And I'm a big supporter of, there's no reason to go to a planet and plant a flag and say we've been there and come home. I'm a big believer in the mission of humanity needs to become a multi-planet species. And if humanity is going to become a multi-planet species, the place to do it is Mars. Mars is also the best place to do the research on, you know, life and how it came into existence potentially on other planets, or whether it is sustainable on other planets. And so I'm a big believer in, you know, a multi-decadal plan that ends in Mars that I'll talk about here mostly in a minute. But I've gotten to know Stephen Hawking through all the space stuff I've been doing recently. We flew him on a zero-G flight, and I've gotten to know him a lot more since then, took some of his work up to the space station and back. And as you likely know, he is also a big proponent of the fact that humanity must become a multi-planet species, not only for the reasonable probability that in the great span of time, life on any planet will be threatened by extinction through asteroids or biology or nuclear, or even if you go out much, much, much further, of course, when the sun supernovas, of course, it'll all be over anywhere near this region. And so we have a lot of time to prepare for that one. Hi, Peter, by the way. Have you been here this whole time? Oh, by the way, you guys have heard me talking about how the X Prize is the place that the new space race began. And Peter Diamandis, right here in the front row, is the visionary founder of the X Prize and Space Adventures and Zero G Corp. If I had to blame or give credit to the future of humanity in space, it is this guy right here, Peter Diamandis. Thank you for coming. And in fact, I would actually say that he is the guy that I have followed on so many of these wild missions into the future. Yeah, and I didn't take you on my space flight. Sorry about that. But obviously you'll go soon. So here is my plan for what I would call, you know, whenever, in fact, I literally last week, or not even last week, was Monday. I was at NASA headquarters in D.C. on Monday, and, you know, talking to them about the future. And this is sort of what I, you know, lobby for personally whenever I talk to people inside or outside NASA. You know, I think any 30-year plan like we had with Constellation that required a huge increase in budget and a huge amount of time span is impossible. And it's impossible because of economic ups and downs that would have to survive, and it's also impossible because of the what I'll call political turbulence that come out every couple of generations as they change their mind as to what's important, you know, domestically or internationally, or, you know, to do with taxpayers' money. And so I think any grand plan, while I have the grand plan of humanity becomes a multi-planet species, you have to break that down into basically decadal bites that people can get their head around, stick by that one vision, and if the vision wavers at the end of that decade, it's okay. You can pick back up again whenever the mood is and the political climate is willing. And so in my mind, the first decade, the decade we're about to go into right now, is the decade to focus on things like suborbital tourism and research, to focus on really getting commercial activity thriving in low Earth orbit. And while NASA leaves most of that to commercial, their job is to move us out as far at least as asteroids and determine what, if anything, is of value there in asteroids. And if there's commercial value there, then they can turn that again over to private industry. And if there's nothing there that we can easily bring back home, then they can move on to the next decadal plan to push further out. Which then brings us to the second decade. For me, the second decadal plan is that for NASA to build research stations on those low-gravity moons that I was talking about, these outposts much further away from Earth, prove that we can travel much further away from the Earth, prove that we have a life support system to go much further out. We'll have a great opportunity to look for, on icy moons for life. We'll have the opportunity to have great outposts near Mars to look down on Mars to look for future landing zones, things of that nature. And also during this next decade, by the way, Peter, I'm signing up for something here. I believe in that second decade, NASA should run commercial prizes like the XPRIZE, or potentially even in concert with the XPRIZE, to build a supply chain on the surface of Mars. I think that if NASA was to say, I'm going to build a mission to go to Mars and build a habitat, you know, we would spend two decades and many, 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 many billions of dollars doing it. On the other hand, if they put up a single prize that said, I have a $1 billion prize for the first people to build a survivable igloo on the surface, lots of people would do it. We proved in the XPRIZE that it's 100 to 1 or at least 10 to 1 fold that people will invest on trying to win that prize. So they leverage their prize money dramatically. They have another $1 billion prize for sequestering oxygen and fuel, another $1 billion prize for build me a greenhouse so I can have some food when I get there, all in preparation for the third decade. And for me, that third decade is when NASA leads the charge for humanity to become a multi-planet species. They charter a mission to not only go to Mars, but I'm actually one of the crazy people that thinks that first mission to Mars should be one way. And the reason why I think it should be one way is because it's a heck of a lot easier. To get people off the planet of Mars and come back is basically as hard as getting them there in the first place. And so to require the infrastructure to bring them home puts off in time and money that goal so far into the future, I just don't think it's worth it. And I think if you ask, in fact, when I usually go into a room and I ask, you know, who would go to Mars one way, if, as long as you knew you'd survive and there are other people there to, in fact, I'll ask now since you're so popular. So if you could go to Mars and you didn't have to pay for it, it was free, and it was safe enough, you're going to survive, and when you got there, it was safe enough, you would survive, and there's enough people there to make it a rich experience for you to continue to build more habitats and grow your territory. You're not going to terraform it. It's going to be you're going to live in domes and spacesuits, but you're going to make it nicer and nicer over time. And eventually, someday, you will be able to come back, or if not, maybe not you, your children. Who would go? Okay. Look at this. So think about it. So that's almost half the people in this room. And so, you know, finding volunteers for this one-way mission is a completely trivial issue. And so that's why I'm so convinced that there's just no need to make it two-way. And it's so, and we can, and therefore, we can actually do it in just a few decades. And what I find interesting to point out about this new era that we're in is that if you look at the space agencies of Earth, you know, the group that has flown the most people into space is NASA, with, you know, just over 300. Then the Russians, then the Europeans, then the Canadians, then the Japanese, and then our company, Space Adventures. And I actually think I might be slightly dated. It's possible China has surpassed us at this point. This slide's a few months old, so I don't know how many people China's flown today, but we're in a race with China. But we're basically the sixth largest space agency on Earth is a private company. And so, you know, I've sort of outlined to you kind of what we're doing about it, how amazing I believe it is. And so my challenge for you guys is to say, look, you know, it's one thing to kind of listen and be inspired, which I hope you are by this kind of talk. But, you know, those of us who are doing this just elected to do so, if you know what I mean. You know, I think, Peter, you actually might have an aerospace aeronautics degree or something, but I'm a college dropout. And so, you know, this is something all of us can participate in. Just like John Carmack is out there building rockets right now that can go to space. You know, it's just an amazing moment that we're in where right now so many of us and so many of our students have the capability to do so much. So my real challenge to you guys is, you know, decide what you want to do about it. How do you want to participate? When do you want to fly? So thank you very much. And I see that I have a few minutes left, so if we have some questions, I believe we have a microphone here at the front. So if you want to cue at the mic, and I'll be happy to answer a few questions.
Hi.
Hi. We actually didn't test that mic ahead of time, so just speak loud and use the mic, and that'll be the cue, but I'll repeat the question if needed.
My name's Tierney O'Day. I'm a science writer, among other things, but I have a question that I can't seem to get a straight answer on. What's the deal with the X-37B? Now that the military's developed it, why can't NASA have a nice little space plane for their own?
And you know, I'd give you a straight answer if I had the data,
but
honestly, I don't. I mean, but yes, for those of you who don't know, this X-37B is a military mini shuttle, I'll call it, that has actually already now flown in space and reentered and been recovered. As far as I know, everything's been perfectly good about it. It's sort of like that little Sierra Nevada Dream Chaser is the closest comparable I would think of. I would have the same question. Unfortunately, I don't have any data that you don't about why.
No theories or anything?
I truly have no theory, other than this Department of Defense. But I agree, it seems like it would be perfectly suitable for one of the vehicles of this next generation.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, I didn't have a better answer.
Hey, Richard. What do you think is the position of places like hackerspaces and makerspaces inside this collective of, you know, there's the commercial, there's the government, and then it's kind of we the people.
With suborbital space, there is unquestionably plenty of maker faire level activity. That's why I was saying FIRST Robotics is the good parallel for me. In that, you know, if you haven't had a chance to go up to Dallas and go to Cato Mills Airport, where the Armadillo Aerospace guys operate, you know, they're pretty good about letting people come in and take a tour of the place, and they launch at least twice a week to try to do some tests outside in their backyard, basically. And as soon as you see that, it's incredibly inspirational because you realize you kind of go like, hey, I could have done that. Hey, I could have done that. You know, and so the two parts that I couldn't have done are, I think John Carmack is one of the most brilliant code writers on Earth. And so the command and control systems he's working on are very sophisticated. And even as a programmer myself, I'm going like, I'd be hard pressed to beat him. And he's got a brilliantly designed nozzle. Non-ablative, reusable nozzle that now on this thing called rocket racing is being used a lot to prove the reusability and maintenance of these things. But other than those two very hard parts, which in theory now you can buy from him,
right.
Everything else you can build with kits you get from FIRST Robotics or a similar kind of kit, if you know what I mean.
I mean, we have our ATX hackerspace right here, and there are a number of us who are trying to get to 75,000 feet and above.
Yeah.
We'd love to see you come by.
No, I'd love to. I'll come visit. No, because I believe that is a big part of the future. Absolutely. Okay, thank you.
Randall Teichla. I'm a math teacher, and currently I'm applying to NASA. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you is... already been to the space station. I'm preparing for them to call me up for interviews in August. And what should I do to be ready?
A very excellent question. You know, what I found interesting about my preparations for spaceflight is, you know, of course, you're not sure about what's the training going to be like. You know, how hard is it going to be? How competent am I going to feel when I get there? You know, how behind the other astronauts? You know, I'm a college dropout. You know, am I going to feel like a dropout? You know, or am I going to feel like I'm a competitor with these guys? I was actually shocked how normal everything felt. And here's what I mean about that. I'll get back to my recommendation in a second. But for example, if you're a scuba diver and you understand the general concepts of partial pressures of gases as they associate with diving and getting the bends and things like this, and that, then you basically already know the life support systems on board a spacecraft. If you can handle a ham radio, an amateur radio, and you've learned about frequencies and wavelengths and power and the basic operations of this comm equipment, you can handle all the radios on board any spacecraft. If you're reasonably good with physics, then you can handle orbital mechanics because it's all Newtonian. It's not really that, you know, complicated. You know, so there's this handful of subjects going like, oh, okay, that's high school this, high school this, high school this. I mean, literally, as long as you paid attention in high school, you can handle most every subject you need to know to really be able to master to fly in space. Even before I went, I thought, okay, you know, I got in the best shape I was in my whole life before I went to Russia. I'd ran 3 to 5 miles every day. I was 30 pounds lighter than I am right now. I was literally the best shape of my life I've been in since high school. I arrived there to find out I was in way better shape than the rest of them. And then I've been downhill ever since, including, you know, but here's the one thing. So when you come to advice, here's the one thing I would do.
Right.
My advice to getting into NASA or becoming a, quote, professional astronaut is strangely the same as I would give people trying to apply for a job in the games industry. The answer is that you have to try over and over and over again, because the time your resume lines up with what they're willing to hire is a random point in the future, which is not very likely the first time you apply. And each time you apply, you will learn a little bit more about why it did or didn't work. And therefore, your next application will be smarter. And almost every astronaut I know that has come in, you know, in the last decade has tried about 5 times before they kind of got to know the people involved in the decision-making, et cetera, because there's so few people selected compared to the people that apply that you'll never make it through on just the probability role. Right. You'll really only get in by getting to know the people that are involved in the decision-making and finding out what criteria they need for you to fix, whether it's medical or knowledge or whatever else it might be.
Well, I'd love to get a chance to meet with you and talk about that.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Hello, Mr. Gerhardt. Thank you for this opportunity to ask you a question.
Sure, of course.
I have two real quick. I definitely believe in future space exploration, but how do you tackle the proponents that Curiosity, the Mars rover, is the way to proceed? And the second would be if you have corporations exploring space, won't they try to own it? And how do you handle that?
Okay, very interesting question about the role of robotics and ownership. Interestingly, you know, a lot of people who are against human spaceflight would use the argument that, by the way, it's a lot cheaper, it's a lot safer, by definition, to humans, to send robots to go do this work instead. And the Curiosity and Opportunity and the three rovers are, you know, great examples of huge successes on a relatively minor budget compared to what it would take to send people. But what's interesting is, so by the way, anywhere we can use robots, we absolutely should, because it is so much safer and cheaper. But what's interesting about human spaceflight is if you go, I can tell you stories both from my own time, but all the way back to the first scientist we put on the moon. So the first and only time we put a geologist on the moon was the first and only time that geologist, who had used his own eyes, not a robotic camera, but his own instincts and his own visual interpretation, that he was immediately drawn to pick out rocks that he recognized as being special and unusual. He brought those back to the Earth, and it turns out those were part of the primordial crust of the moon, which was extremely important to not only date the moon, but show how and when the moon first began to form and cool, which also then gives you big information about the Earth's formation, which tells you all kinds of things about the history of evolution on the Earth. And that kind of work, I don't think, can ever be done by robots. I actually think that while robots can and should be used for a huge swath of this, and like the things on Curiosity that's going to Mars right now, you know, if it can manage to suss out chemicals that might, you know, be indicators of life, you know, then clearly that's a, you know, clearly that's a good thing. But nothing's going to beat following it up with people to come visit afterwards.
You said that going into space makes you more of an environmentalist, and I was curious, you know, I hear people talk about the space elevator and 20-kilometer towers. But we're still using chemical propulsion. I'm just wondering, how do you square chemical propulsion with environmentalism in space, and if you see a future without chemical propulsion?
So what's interesting about chemical propulsion is, of course, there's a variety of kinds of propulsion. Like, if you use hydrogen and oxygen, of course, you generate water as your output, so that's not particularly caustic. On the other hand, if you're using solid rocket boosters, that's so caustic that if you're downwind of it, you better go indoors because it'll kill you. And so even using, quote, chemical rockets, there's a lot of variability for what you can do. What's interesting is on the Soyuz that I went up on, even just for good politics, frankly, as much as anything else, I decided to buy carbon offsets for my flight. And what I found was really shocking about the Soyuz is really how little impact it is. I mean, the Soyuz really isn't that big a vehicle, frankly. And, you know, it's got this $800,000 worth of kerosene in it that I mentioned. So we're burning kerosene, jet fuel, same, you know, it's a bit better refinement, but otherwise basically the same thing you put in an airplane or a diesel car. And we burn a lot of it. It's a pretty big tank. What's interesting is, as a lot of it as that is still nothing, or smaller, or approximately the same as one international airplane flight. Well, there's huge number of international airplane flights every day. And there's one rocket, you know, about four to six per year. And so, first of all, it is truly, the amount that we're putting in by rockets today is utterly inconsequential, in my mind. Plus, if it started becoming really common, you can adjust the fuel to becoming less impactful. Use biofuels or other things. There's all kinds of ways to reduce the impact of even the chemical rockets. However, you know, if you look at space elevators, you know, the good news, bad news is that almost anything that you can mathematically theorize should work will, in the great span of time, work. The problem with that, you know, wormholes or space elevators, is that the math also shows how hard it is. You know, in other words, the theory of putting a geosynchronous satellite up that had enough mass to hold one end of a cable and designing a cable strong enough to unroll all the way back down to the surface of the Earth, or at least close enough to reach with a suborbital hop, all the math works. You can even use carbon fiber nanotubes type construction in theory to make it. The problem is, you know, the largest carbon fiber nanotubes that ever existed are microscopic. And the amount of mass that this all would represent is so much more mass than has ever been even conceived to launch into space in the history of humanity, that the amount of fuel you'd have to use to put that all up there using conventional methods would be thousands upon thousands upon thousands of flights that you were already saying you don't want to do for environmental reasons. Add to that the fact that if you screw it up, you drop a cable that would wrap around the Earth many times that would destroy everything in its path as it wrapped around the Earth multiple times. You know, getting permission to do that is going to be, you know, phenomenally difficult. And so I think space elevators, while they're a great theory, I think have no practicality within not only my lifetime but any of our kids' lifetimes. I mean, hypothetically, maybe so. But it's nowhere near close enough to being realizable to start planning on and lobbying for, in my mind. And I'll take this as my last question here.
Hey, Mr. Garrett.
Yeah, sorry about the height there.
I know, right? So I just wanted to first thank you, because I think Altibe 4 probably made me a dork.
Thank you very much.
So I have a lot of respect, and I think you're one of my
heroes. Thank you.
That was like the Apple II days. That was classic. Anyway, my question was about how anti-science our politics have become, and how this country is at a very, very strange time where science is kind of strangely disregarded and disrespected. And convincing people that this is important is obviously, like, it's hugely important to me, even though I'm not involved, but wish I was. And I'm just curious if you have a kind of an opinion on what we can do about that strange kind of political world we're in right now.
Yeah, well, first of all, I completely agree with you. It is shocking how anti-science our culture has become. And it's not just the government, it's literally the community that we live in has become strangely anti-science. And so I think that part of the reason we've become that way, and I definitely believe that the reason by which how we can fix it, is the case has to be made. You know, I think the day of making the public case based on things like inspiration and or even directly as education aren't strong enough to the public. Now, what's interesting is, you know, as Peter likes to, I'm not sure how often he points it out, but I know he knows the statistic and I've heard him mention it a number of times, the X Prize being won, correct me if I'm wrong, Peter, but it was like the number one or two news event of the year.
And I'll be speaking at five conventions there for you to think about the models.
Okay, Convention Center EF at 5 o'clock. And by the way, Peter's just released a new book, Abundance, which is a phenomenal book that also talks a lot about the future and why people should be much more optimistic than I think people are. But again, the case, I think the economic case, the rewards of exploration, the rewards even of science, I mean, there's certain things like everybody loves the pretty pictures from Hubble. Everybody loves the cool machine, the CERN super collider. But everybody also goes like, whoa, man, how many billions of dollars we spent to put that up? And those only cross over to captivating the public eye because they have such pretty pictures, I'll call it. When you spend that kind of money and you don't get back either really, really, really pretty pictures and or a pretty direct showcase of, look, spend this, get this, it's pretty easy for the public to check out. And so that's why I think the solution is we've got to turn this commercial and we've got to prove the business case. Even the biggest doubters will not doubt the business case. And what's interesting about proving it through the business case is then you will get the inspiration, just like with the XPRIZE. The XPRIZE, you know, we only raised about $250,000, I think, of the $10 million that we originally was required for that prize. And yet, it was a hard-fought battle up till we got the prize money together. But then as soon as that prize money was set, bam, competitors came out of the woodwork, funding came out of the woodwork, and in only a few short years, it was resoundingly won, and an entire industry immediately was born. And so all you got to do is get it over the hill. We just got to push that ball up the hill far enough to get to this pinnacle where people understand the value proposition. And we're on it. Okay, and I'm really out of time, but since you're one of the operators, are you here to set me down or ask a question? Oh, ownership in space. Okay, I'll answer that one as my final. Sorry, this will be my last comment. I already, by the way, believe I claim a small piece of the moon. And even though you might say that it's on shaky grounds, let me give you my justification and why this is still okay, by the way. There is a ratified UN treaty that says no government shall lay claim to property off Earth. And the reason why they did that is just like in Antarctica, where as soon as they thought there was a land grab, people started doing all kinds of crazy stuff, like not only planting their own flags, but America sent a guy, Robert Byrd, down there with an airplane, and he threw flags out the window and said, "That's now America." Okay, well, I've got my flag on the moon, so that's now mine, by the same justification. But that's why they ratified these treaties to say, hey, by the way, it's not okay for governments to go claim this extraterrestrial property. Another UN treaty came up to try to some groups proposed to block private ownership of property off of the planet Earth. And that specifically was not ratified by the United States and Russia, the only two spacefaring countries at the time, because they felt it was really important to the only reason somebody's going up there and say mine an asteroid is if once they find there's gold in them, their hills, and figure out a way to get it home, they can control their claim. And so it turns out we already do this. You know, like, for example, if there's a geosynchronous satellite up above the Earth to watch TV from, that one spot in space, you need to make sure no one else is going to bump into your satellite because you put a lot of money into putting it there. And so the United Nations already allows you to make claims of empty space as long as you continue to utilize it. But if you ever fall out or give up on it or your satellite decays away, you give up your claim on that particular piece of space. By the way, my rover, which you might think of as long since dead, actually took up a series of mirrors that are on the back of my rover, which are still used to this day to do Earth-Moon distance calculations for doing the precise measurements that are done in observatories all around the globe. And so I would say my rover is still in active use. So therefore, my claim is still active. Peter, I think you missed when I mentioned mentioned the XPRIZE idea of giving bonuses to the XPRIZE people who go there and land as long as they pay me a parking fee, and I will pay them for photographs and a little quid pro quo that'll help establish both of our claims on property on the moon. So I think it's a good thing. So thanks.